Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We haven't told you very much about this, but I do want to remind you that tomorrow we are going to be broadcasting live from Appleton, Wisconsin. We're heading up there this afternoon. We'll be at the History Museum at the Castle in downtown Appleton from 9 until 11. We've been to Appleton before and have always had a good time. At 9 o'clock, we'll be talking about the hands-on exhibit, Leonardo da Vinci, Machines in Motion, which has replicas of 40 inventions from the famous artist. He was quite a guy, wasn't he? And the second hour, we'll talk about efforts to encourage technical education and to fill skilled manufacturing jobs in the Fox Valley. You don't need tickets for the live broadcast. Space is limited, though, so come early to get a good seat. And you can find more information about the whole deal at wpr.org/northeast. This hour, the author of From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Our guest is Michael Klarman. Michael is a professor at Harvard Law School, where he teaches constitutional law and constitutional history. He has also written a couple other books looking primarily at the civil rights movement and John versus the Board of Education, Brown versus the Board of Education. He became first interested in the whole topic of judicial decisions and political backlash when he was figuring out the effects of Brown v. Board of Education. And he looks in this book at the cases that the Supreme Court may take up related to gay marriage. He looks at same-sex marriage litigation, the political backlash that it has produced, and we'll also look at how one of these many cases may find its way to the Supreme Court and whether or not the court should rule broadly on gay marriage or if narrowly might be better for a movement for same-sex marriage. So it should be a really interesting hour. We ask you to join our conversation at 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Michael. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Let's go back to when you were doing the book on Brown v. the Board of Education. This book actually was inspired by all of the work that you did many years ago on that case.
Right. So I spent a long time trying to figure out what exactly were the consequences of Brown versus Board of Education. Conventionally, the main consequence, I think, is seen as inspiring the civil rights movement, the direct action protests of the early 1960s, the sit-ins and freedom rides and street demonstrations. I discovered as I was working on the case that Brown had another effect, which was in the short term in the South, it actually radicalized racial politics. It created opportunities for extreme segregationists to run for and win political office. And it actually led to some retrogression on race policy. So, for example, in Mississippi, it became much harder for African Americans to vote after Brown than it had been before Brown. It became harder to desegregate local bus transportation or sporting competitions. So then when you combine the direct action movement of the 1960s with the radicalized political environment that Brown had created in the South, you actually got a situation where violence erupted when politicians like George Wallace and Bull Connor were confronted with direct action protesters. And it was that violence, when it was translated through television to northern viewing audiences, that actually led to demand for civil rights legislation in the 1960s.
Meaning that the lesson that we need to learn is that whatever case the Supreme Court decides to take up, as it will probably this year deal with the issue of same-sex marriage, that it might be better them for them to take something that's more narrow rather than a blanket same-sex marriage is constitutional, it's unconstitutional not to allow it.
So that's one possible lesson you could draw from the story that I've told, but I don't think it's the only lesson. Same-sex marriage litigation in the state courts, starting back in Hawaii 20 years ago, then culminating in the first square victory for gay marriage in the Massachusetts Supreme Court 9 years ago, those lawsuits clearly produced dramatic political backlashes. The Hawaii litigation led to 35 states passing defense of marriage statutes. The Massachusetts court decision led to 25 states passing constitutional amendments banning gay marriage, and it had a profound effect on elections in 2004. But those decisions came at times that the country was overwhelmingly opposed to gay marriage. Opinion polls showed in the 1990s that three-quarters of Americans opposed it. At the time of the Massachusetts decision, two-thirds of Americans still oppose gay marriage. Today, most polls show a narrow majority in favor, so I would be a little bit more reluctant to draw a confident lesson that a Supreme Court decision in favor of gay marriage would generate dramatic political backlash. It might in some places. It probably wouldn't in others. We see in the 2012 presidential election that the issue simply is not discussed very much.
That's dramatically
different from 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that it takes us so darn long sometimes to get where we're eventually going to be?
Right. So that's a great question. If this is an inevitable development, why don't people simply recognize that and climb on the bandwagon? A couple different explanations. One is it's not always clear what is inevitable. I do think gay marriage in the United States within the next decade or two is going to sweep across the nation, and people will look back and say, why was this ever controversial? But you might have said the same thing 40 years ago when the Supreme Court in 1972 struck down the death penalty and when the Supreme Court in 1973 struck down abortion regulations. I think in both those circumstances, the justices probably thought they were just pushing the country in a direction that it was already inevitably trending toward. And in both of those situations, the change stopped and in some cases actually was set back. So the death penalty became more popular after the Supreme Court struck it down. And abortion restrictions, I wouldn't say became more popular, but the change toward liberalization of abortion laws pretty much stopped after the Supreme Court decision. So that's one point, right? We shouldn't always assume that we know a particular social change is inevitable. It may look inevitable and turn out not to be. The other point is that people are invested in the status quo. Some people have material investments in the status quo. Some people have ideological investments, meaning they bought into a worldview that is rooted in a particular understanding, and people find it profoundly unsettling to give up that understanding. So, you know, for hundreds of years, we've had a system that emphasized heteronormativity. The American Psychiatric Association regarded homosexuality as a mental illness until 40 years ago. Every state in the country criminalized same-sex sodomy until 40 years ago. And around that state of affairs develops a powerful ideological viewpoint that there's something wrong with homosexuality. And people have a hard time giving that up, although we're seeing very dramatically in the last 20 years people's views are changing, and I frankly don't see that changing in the other direction.
Yeah. Well, what is it that's making views change? It seems to me as though within even the last 10 years, views on this issue have changed quite dramatically. Why?
They have. You're exactly right. So in 2000, still, you know, two-thirds of the country opposed gay marriage, and not a single state had it. And today, six states have it. Three more states may actually vote in favor of it. On November 6th, and opinion polls now regularly show a narrow majority supporting it, and that's increasing at the rate of a couple percentage points a year. There are a couple of factors that are especially important. One is the coming out phenomenon, and this was something that gay rights activists have understood for the last 40 years. As the social climate becomes more receptive toward people being open about their sexual orientation, more people come out because the consequences are no longer so costly. Mm. And as more people come out, more people know people who are openly gay. And not just knowing them, but they're their friends and their family members, their loved ones, their neighbors, their coworkers. And social science studies regularly show that the most important factor in predicting progressive views about equality with regard to sexual orientation or whether you know and are close to people who are openly gay. Then the second factor, which is related to that, is the youth view. Young people are much, much more supportive of gay marriage and, in general, equality without regard to sexual orientation. They grow up in a culture where this is just second nature to them. They see television characters, celebrities who are openly gay, and they just don't think twice about it, and that becomes the new normal for them, and anything that derogates from that they see as rank discrimination, which right. they frankly don't have much sympathy for. And so you see that in opinion polls showing that 70% of people under the age of 30 support same-sex marriage, whereas at the other end of the age spectrum, people over 65, the number is much more like 30 or 40%. So as younger people become more influential politically, as they start to vote in larger numbers, this is just going to change incredibly quickly.
Parts of the book that I found, I mean, it's a very interesting book, but it was fascinating to be reminded of epics in American history that weren't that long ago, and I'd like for you to describe a few of them. You talk about what it was like to be gay in this country after World War II, and holy cow, it's just such a different world, isn't it?
It is a different world, and it's incredible to think how much social change can take place in 50 or 60 years. So, you know, back, take 1960, for example, as a benchmark, 50 years ago, literally every state in the country made it a crime for consenting adults to engage in same-sex sex. The American Civil Liberties Union, the organization that you would think would be most inclined to have a problem with that state of affairs, did not think there was any constitutional problem with criminalizing private consensual same-sex sex. The U.S. government went on a witch hunt in the 1950s, dismissing thousands of people who were gay from employment. You could not be a member of the United States military if you were openly gay. Police departments in many, if not most, cities still regularly raided gay bars, not allowing people even to congregate on the theory that if they congregated, they were likely or perhaps possibly going to engage in sex, which was forbidden under the criminal law of every state. It was even, maybe the most dramatic point, it was even so costly to be identified as a member of a gay rights group that the budding gay rights organizations of the 1950s, the Mattachine Society, for example, nobody wanted to be an open member. If they subscribed to a gay magazine, they didn't want to receive it in the mail in the way that the postmaster would see that they were receiving it, because then the postmaster would refer them to the FBI, and the FBI would refer them to their employer, and they'd be fired from their job. So it's an incredible state of affairs 50 years ago. People who don't study the history just have no idea how dramatically we've moved in 50 years.
Mm-hmm. And it has been, you also write about how politically risky it has been for people who have been at the forefront. You talk about justices on the Iowa Supreme Court who were defeated because they had ruled in favor of gay marriage. It wasn't all that long ago that if you expressed your opinion on it, there was a backlash.
Right. Gay rights groups actually had a hard time in the 1950s and 1960s getting a lawyer to advocate their cause, because the lawyer would be generally supposed to be homosexual, and then the lawyer would have a hard time getting employment. And
goodness.
You had to Sorry?
I just said goodness.
Yeah, right. It's incredible. But that you know, that's kind of similar with movements that are challenging deeply rooted oppression. African Americans who are trying to bring civil rights lawsuits in the South in the 1930s or 1940s couldn't get white lawyers to take their cases, for the most part, because the consequences, the social ostracism and the economic reprisals against the white lawyers would be so great that they wouldn't take the case, meaning you could only get black lawyers, and, you know, blacks weren't allowed into law schools in southern states, so it's very hard to become trained as a black lawyer. Same thing with gay rights movement, right? Very difficult to get a lawyer to take your case because the consequences, the ostracism, the economic reprisals would be significant. You could imagine celebrities really would not want to identify themselves with the cause of gay rights because there would be significant costs borne to their celebrity status. You know, lots of ways in which an oppressive status quo kind of entrenches itself in power and makes it very difficult to challenge. Hard to organize politically if you can't come out openly as gay, and when the costs are so great, losing employment, being ostracized by your friends and families, might be difficult to promote political change. But if you can't mobilize politically, then how are you supposed to change all the laws that are so disadvantageous?
Michael Klarman, our guest this hour, his book is From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. We want to talk more about three more states putting same-sex marriage on the ballot and how it will be phrased for the November 6 elections, and also much more on the Supreme Court. Obviously, there is a lot of talk, and it was piqued by one of the justices saying, yes, probably this year we will take up this issue. What's the best way, in Michael's opinion, for them to take up this issue, and what's the likely way for them to take up the issue? Did I give you the phone number? Here it is again, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Michael Klarman, 800-486-8655. His book is From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. He is a professor at Harvard Law School, where he teaches constitutional law and constitutional history. And we go to Darren in Viroqua for our first caller. Hi, Darren.
Morning. Hello, are you there?
Yes, Darren, go ahead.
Okay, great. I remember the good old days of the Reagan years when I was afraid I could lose my job, my apartment. Minnesota at the time didn't have the protections it has now, and I wanted to go to West Point. Steve Gunderson, our congressman, wanted to send me to West Point, and he's out as a gay man, but I told the truth in 1984, and that was the end of my military career. It is interesting, however, that in times of war, the military looks the other way and accepts our gay servicemen and women. But then in times of peace, then the witch hunts started again. I'm, of course, 100% supportive of gay marriage, and I'm 45, but I'm encouraged. I'm in class now for RN school. I'm encouraged to see the younger generation coming up who have no problem with gay marriage. And if you speak out against gay marriage in academia today, you are viewed as some kind of retrograde dinosaur. So that's very encouraging to me.
Michael.
So a lot of interesting points in there. The point about wartime is interesting. It's often been during wartime that the United States has made significant progress on issues of social reform. So African Americans fighting during the Civil War afterwards got the right to vote. The modern civil rights movement is largely a product of World War II, when Americans had to reconsider their racial views because they were fighting against Nazi fascism with its theories of Aryan supremacy, but they were doing it with a racially segregated military. Many African American soldiers came back home after fighting for democracy overseas, and they decided it would be great if they could experience some democracy at home. And you see the same thing with other social reform movements in war. Women got the right to vote after World War I, largely because of the supportive role they had played in bolstering the war effort on the home front. The Reagan years were barren years, at least at the federal level, for the gay rights movement. Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980. The moral majority played a significant role in boosting his electoral triumph. The moral majority had just been formed the preceding year, and part of their agenda, a significant part of their agenda, was restricting any expansion in the rights of gays. They regard homosexuality as immoral, and they were determined that the government do nothing to make homosexuality seem normal. The Reagan administration had a terrible record in supporting AIDS funding for research, and so forth. So that was a really tough time. The AIDS epidemic, of course, was deadly, killing tens of thousands of gays and others. Afterwards, though, it did have the effect of forcing many people out of the closet, and it's not a coincidence that it's in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that you see a real burst of support for the gay rights movement, and you see a beginning of a focus on legal recognition of gay relationships. The first important court decision recognizing that gay couples could be a family was a New York decision from 1989 involving whether a gay couple could succeed, whether one partner could succeed to the other under a rent control ordinance that allowed families to benefit, and the question is whether they counted as a family, and one of them had died in the AIDS epidemic. So, you know, even though the AIDS epidemic was devastating to the gay community, it did lead to many people coming out, which has this effect, and it also emphasized the importance of legal recognition for same-sex relationships, which is kind of where the movement toward gay marriage started about 20, 25 years ago.
Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. It seems to me that so many of the objections to gay marriage are religiously based. And I was just looking at Loving versus West Virginia dealing with interracial marriage. That was 1967. That wasn't when the Supreme Court unanimously declared that state laws prohibiting interracial marriage could not stand. And I may have moral objections to all kinds of things. I mean, gambling or whatever. But I don't think and also a lot of people who supported DOMA originally, Defense of Marriage Act, including some very conservative lawyers, have changed their mind on it. Bill Clinton has changed his mind. I just find there not being a sound reason in law, not in scripture, but in law, for prohibiting people from forming contracts. And I wonder if your guests could talk about some of these people who have changed their mind, and also the whole concept of contract law, that people should be able to make contracts with one another that have standing before the courts. Sally Ride, a very famous astronaut-type person, was in a same-sex relationship, and I guess her survivor could not get any justice because it was a same-sex relationship. Sorry to go on so long, but thank you.
Thanks, Rich.
Yeah, so there are a lot of interesting points in the question. I agree. The main reason why people oppose same-sex marriage is because in many people's minds, this is not what the Bible says. This is not what God intended for marriage to be. In court, you're not allowed to make that argument. Every law has to be grounded in some sort of secular government purpose, and that leads the government to defend against challenges. When people bring challenges to traditional marriage definitions, the government tends to defend it on grounds like it's better for children to be raised by biological parents, or we want to preserve a connection between marriage and procreation. And those aren't the real reasons driving the resistance to same-sex marriage. The real reason is religion, but you're not allowed to make that argument in court. When you make these other arguments, because they're not the real arguments, they seem a little bit strained. So why is it that preventing same-sex couples from getting married is going to have any effect on whether children are raised by their biological parents? We allow gay individuals to adopt children. In most states, we allow gay couples to adopt children. These children are going to be raised by a gay couple, and the only question is, are the children better off if the couple is married or not? And it's very hard to see why they wouldn't be better off if their parents could get married. So the fact that the main objection is religious, but under our constitutional jurisprudence, you're not allowed to make the religion argument, leads to these strained arguments, which don't strike many courts as very persuasive. The other point of what Rich was saying, I want to at least briefly respond to this idea that we ought to just let people form whatever contracts they want, at least if they're informed consenting adults. There are two questions here. First of all, where in the Constitution does it say that? Where does it say the government's not allowed to impose its moral judgments? Where does it say we're constitutionalizing John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, the idea that people are entitled to make their own free choices? That's one problem. It's not obvious that the Constitution says that. The other problem is, if you really believe that any two consenting adults ought to be able to engage in any behavior that doesn't adversely affect third parties, then you start to get into relations like polygamy and polyamory, the idea of multiple relationships. So, you know, if it's really consenting adults, why ought a man not to be able to marry two women, or, you know, two women and marry one, two women marry, you know, three men? Why shouldn't it have marriages like that? those are complicated questions. I mean, if you want to distinguish those from gay marriage, you're going to need to come up with some sort of argument about why there's not true consent there. Traditionally, polygamy has been practiced in societies that do not treat seriously the rights of women. So you might argue there is, in fact, a third-party effect, that this is discriminatory toward women. Often polygamy is practiced in ways that is preying on small children, and obviously small children, we don't presume, are able to consent to those sorts of relationships. But it's not hard to imagine a situation in which adults who genuinely know what they're doing decide to pursue some unconventional relationship other than one man and one woman or one man and one man. You know, multiples are possible. And I think those are going to be questions that in the next century people are going to take more seriously, because I do think as a society we're becoming more libertarian, we're more resistant to the idea of government simply imposing its moral views, and we're going to have to figure out how those things are different or whether they are different.
Well, I need to ask the question about the Supreme Court and whether or not you think that they will be deciding same-sex marriage this session, and what's the avenue, and what would their deliberations include? On what basis, what part of law would they be looking at?
So there are two different issues, Kathleen, that they might grant review in. One is the Defense of Marriage Act. That's the federal law that supplies a federal definition of marriage for federal purposes, for immigration purposes, for Social Security survivors benefits purposes. That federal statute was adopted in 1996. A bunch of lower courts have started to invalidate it in the last 2 years. The First Circuit, which is the federal court governing New England, the Second Circuit, which is the federal court governing New York, Vermont, Connecticut, those courts have both struck the law down. The Obama administration is no longer defending the law in court. That would be a case that the Supreme Court is quite likely to take this term, and I think quite likely to strike down. It would be a combination of liberal justices who are sympathetic to same-sex marriage and conservative justices who might not buy into the idea of same-sex marriage but are not clear why the federal government should be defining marriage rather than leaving it, as is traditionally done, to the states. Right? The federal law refuses to defer to a state like Massachusetts, which allows same-sex marriage, and justices who care about federalism might say, we don't understand why the federal government needs to have an interest on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
The other case would be a state law banning same-sex marriage. So Proposition 8 in California in 2008 barred same-sex marriage, and there has been a constitutional challenge to that. That challenge won on very narrow grounds in the Ninth Circuit, which is the federal appellate court covering the West Coast, and the Supreme Court could grant review in that case. That would be a harder case for the justices, and I think they are likely to divide along the usual political lines that they divide on, which is 5-4. There's one conservative block and there's one liberal block, and they differ on almost all issues: abortion, the death penalty, affirmative action, gun control. They divide 5-4. The decisive vote on all these issues is Justice Kennedy, and then it just becomes a question of predicting what Justice Kennedy is likely to do on same-sex marriage. And I'm happy to talk about that for a while if you're interested, or I'm happy to move on to something else.
All right. Well, we'll get back to it if we have time.
Okay.
That's always interesting. Here's an email that's come in. Wouldn't abolishing marriage licensing altogether be the most practical way to ensure that all can be married to the one they love?
So that's certainly one possibility, is you simply deregulate marriage. The state no longer expresses an opinion on who one individual should be married, but churches get to decide on who they marry religiously. There's a fair amount of support for that. Many people are puzzled why government gets to have an opinion on who you choose to spend the rest of your life with. There's certainly movement in some European countries in that direction, and that would preserve it to churches that are opposed to same-sex marriage, like, for example, the Mormon Church or the Catholic Church. They would decide who they want to marry, and nobody argues that they're not free to do that. It's clearly established constitutional law that churches have a free exercise right to sanctify religiously whatever marriage they want. They're absolutely free about to do that, and maybe the government could just get out of the business of marrying gay couples. Other people would be resistant to that. They say, we like the idea that there is this civil institution of marriage, and as same-sex couples, we don't see why we should be discriminated against. Governments have approved marriages for hundreds of years, and we don't think it would be right if government got out of the business just because now we're the ones asking for it. If you wanted an analogy, it would be sort of like government running public pools, and then once black people demanded the right to be integrated in their use of the pools, the government shutting down the pools, which happened across the South in the 1960s and was challenged as unconstitutional. Right? You don't have to run a public pool, but you shouldn't close it because you are racist and oppose integration. And I think some people would say the same thing about marriage. You shouldn't stop marrying people just because you aren't comfortable with the idea of same-sex couples benefiting from it.
Jeff in Superior, hi.
Hi, I can ask my question in less than a minute. I'm a Christian, and I personally believe that marriage is marriage between a man and a woman, and also I think gay couples can relate to, say, Jonathan and David in Psalms. They had clearly a same-sex relationship. But I want to take the whole sexual component out of this discussion and look at the legal question, and here's my question. If you just look at gender identity, the physical aspects of a man and the physical aspects of a woman, if they get into a relationship and they want to call it a marriage, in my opinion, that should be legally acknowledged if the state chooses to do so. But when you have a same-sex couple and they want a civil union or domestic partnership or whatever, to me that's not a marriage because of the word being used by another gender identity. Because if a same-sex couple, one of the people has a sex change operation, then clearly their gender identity has changed, and you would have to call that relationship something else. So if you just look at it from a gender identity question, how is separate not equal and equally protected under the law? How is separate not equal?
Well, I think the objection that same-sex couples make to calling it something else, a domestic partnership or a civil union, is the same objection that African Americans raised to the idea that we would have segregated schools, but they would be equal in terms of their funding. You have to ask the question, why is it that we're saying to a certain group, we're going to put you in a different category? And the usual objection to that, which I think is quite powerful, is that it's stigmatic, that the very purpose of differentiating between the two groups is to convey an insult and a message of inferiority. And I think gay couples, you know, ironically, 10 years ago, civil unions was something that was seen as a radical reform, and most same-sex couples were happy to have all the rights and obligations of marriage, even without the name marriage. But 10 years down the road, 10 years further on, which is today, they're not happy with that because basically you're saying, well, we're not going to deny you all the rights and benefits, but we're not going to give you the title. And why aren't we going to give you the title? We're not going to give it to you because we think there's something different and inferior about your relationship. So I think the objection is the same objection that was made to segregated schools, which is the only reason why you're separating is because you don't genuinely believe the two groups are equal.
You mentioned three states having, and I'm wondering how they, what they are, if they're all pretty much the same-sex initiatives on ballots on November 6th. Can you talk more about that, what states they are, and if the wording is different, if they're essentially asking the same thing?
Sure. So there are four states that are voting on the issue of same-sex marriage on November 6th. In two of them, Washington State and Maryland, the voters are being asked to approve or disapprove of a law passed by the legislature back in February or March that approved gay marriage. So basically the legislature and the governor in Washington and Maryland approved gay marriage, but there's a provision under state law that if enough people sign a petition, you can then put the issue on the ballot and the voters get to approve or disapprove. In Maine, the issue is not a legislature adopting the law, but rather supporters of gay marriage have decided to put the issue on the ballot, and they're asking voters to approve gay marriage. 3 years earlier in Maine, the legislature had approved gay marriage, and then the people at the next election had overturned that legislation. So gay marriage existed in Maine and was taken away, and now the supporters of gay marriage, this is the first time that this has ever been put on a referendum by proponents, supporters of gay marriage, they're asking voters in the state to approve gay marriage. Then the last issue is in Minnesota, where Republicans, when they got control of the state legislature, decided to propose a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. So in Minnesota, you already have a statute defining marriage as between a man and a woman, but voters are now being asked to go further and to amend the Constitution to define marriage as against a man and a woman, as between a man and a woman. Now, we have opinion polls from all four states. It is very likely that the voters in Washington and Maine will vote in favor of same-sex marriage. It's not a certainty, and opinion polls in the past have always overstated the support for gay marriage, but the opinion polls are sufficiently, the supporters are sufficiently far ahead that I think it is very likely that in those states they will vote in favor. In Maryland, the opinion polls also show that gay marriage is ahead. I expect Maryland to be closer, but I would say right now the odds are probably a little better than 50-50 that Maryland will also endorse gay marriage. Minnesota is the closest of the four. The opinion polls there are almost dead even, and there are two factors that cut in opposite direction. One is if the opinion polls are dead even, usually that means at the ballot box gay marriage will lose. But under Minnesota law, people, if they vote in the presidential election and they vote in the Senate election, but they choose not to vote on the same-sex marriage ballot, that their vote will be counted as voting against the amendment. And that's a small boost for the supporters of same-sex marriage in Minnesota.
So should all of that happen, what you just outlined, isn't that a fairly strong indication that a change is coming, a change is here?
Yeah, well, the change is coming, I think, probably regardless of what happens on November 6th. But I do think it will change the narrative dramatically.
Yes.
That for the first time, people will have voted in favor of same-sex marriage. That's an important part of the narrative of opponents of same-sex marriage, that voters have voted on 31 or 32 occasions, and every time they have rejected same-sex marriage. And I think it is very, very likely that will no longer be the case on November 7th, and that will affect how people talk about this. It's also possible, as I said, I think in three of those states, it's more likely than not that the voters will approve gay marriage. If that happened, then the country would have gone from having six states in favor to having nine states in favor, and there are a bunch more states that are not far behind. So, you know, in California and Oregon and Delaware and Rhode Island and Hawaii, the supporters of gay marriage are very close to putting this on the ballot in the next year or two. And the opinion polls just show dramatic increases year by year. So public support is growing at a rate of 2 or 3% a year, which is why voters are going to approve it by majority vote for the first time, I think, in the next couple weeks.
Michael Klerman, author of From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage, is our guest this hour. We are welcoming your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email you can also use, talk@WPR.org. Go to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, or you can also tweet. I keep forgetting to say that because it's still kind of new to me. You can tweet to @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655. So, Michael, what does Justice Kennedy think about gay marriage?
Yeah, that's the question that everybody has on their minds. I think there are two different predispositions of Justice Kennedy, and they cut in opposite directions on the gay marriage issue. So on the one hand, Justice Kennedy has always been more willing to take dominant social views, turn them into constitutional mandates, and then use those constitutional rights to suppress a handful of states that have been recalcitrant on the issue. So that's what he's done, for example, in cases involving the death penalty for juveniles or the death penalty for people who are mentally disabled. If that's his dominant approach, he's probably not going to be willing to take a rule that's only been adopted in six states so far, which is same-sex marriage, turn it into a federal constitutional command, and then impose it on the other 40-some states. That's the opposite of the way he usually does constitutional law. So that predisposition cuts in one direction. On the other hand, we know that Justice Kennedy, who is the decisive vote on almost every constitutional issue, we know he tends to side with the liberals on gay rights issues. There have been two cases the Supreme Court's decided on gay rights. Both of them, not only did Justice Kennedy vote with the liberals, he wrote the opinion. We also know Justice Kennedy is influenced in his constitutional rulings by international norms, and same-sex marriage is starting to proliferate around the world. And we know that Justice Kennedy cares a lot about his historical reputation. And to me, that might be the most powerful factor here because, as we were discussing earlier, opinion is changing so quickly and so dramatically that it'll only be another decade or two before most people in the country support gay marriage and look back with bewilderment as to why in 2012 this was not an obvious issue. And, you know, who wouldn't want to be the judge writing the opinion that will be quickly regarded as the Brown versus Board of Education of the gay rights movement? People forget that when Brown was decided in 1954, it divided the country almost precisely down the middle, but within two decades, it was regarded by almost everyone as right and just. And I think a ruling in favor of gay marriage would likely be regarded that way pretty quickly. So I think that's awfully tempting for someone who's interested in their historical reputation. And I think we have evidence that Justice Kennedy is one of those people.
Oh, that's interesting. John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Yeah, to kind of follow up on what's being discussed here. And that is, I wonder why referenda are used to determine these issues, because if that were the case, say, obviously Brown versus the Board of Education was just brought up, or even, I mean, if you want to take it even more extreme, the issue of slavery, I would think there would still be states in this country, certainly, that could possibly still have slaves, but certainly Brown versus the Board, if we had allowed it up to the states to decide, there would still be plenty of states in the South that would not allow, would be still supporting Plessy versus Ferguson today.
Yes, that's a terrific point. Why do we use referenda on this issue when we would never dream of using referenda to decide whether government should be segregating African Americans in schools, or even more dramatically, whether government ought to be enslaving people based on their race? This is the basic conundrum of democracy. We believe, on the one hand, on majority rule, and we believe, on the other hand, in minority rights, but we don't have any precise formula for deciding on which issues the majority should rule and on which issues the majority does not get to rule because minority rights are involved. So we're about to have a presidential election. We mostly believe that, you know, we have this complication of the Electoral College, but within each state, we believe that the majority rules. So if 50% plus one vote for President Obama in Wisconsin, we don't have any disagreement about who won Wisconsin, and we don't hear any arguments about how that's unfair to the minority. But we all agree, on the other hand, that we shouldn't have a vote about slavery, and the people who oppose gay marriage and want to vote on it also believe that we should never have a vote on their right to free exercise of religion. They believe that's protected against majority interference. So this is a basic conundrum of democracy, and this is an issue that supporters of gay marriage and opponents simply disagree about. The supporters of gay marriage would say, this is a right, and we don't vote on the rights of minority groups. We simply protect them through the Constitution and the courts. Whereas opponents of gay marriage would say, this is not one of those issues that is somehow protected against majority rule.
And it reminds us that we'll be talking about the Federalist Papers. It's our book club we're doing once a month next week at this time. So we'll be looking at majority rule and minority rights dilemmas. So we'll carry the conversation further. Dave is our next caller in Marshfield. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I've been in and out of the program, and so I think I'll be taking you back a little bit to the two different kinds of marriages. And I noticed that way back in the beginning, there was a different term for gay marriage, a civil union, I think it was. And when the gay movement chose to go with marriage, I thought, boy, this is going to cause a problem because of using the same word for two different things causes the confusion. I think either governments should stop referring to what they do with that contract, stop calling it marriage, or the gay movement ought to, stop calling it marriage. A spiritual marriage happens in in a religious institution, and they can do whatever they want with their marriage and with their marriage, and, you know, the marriage that's legal is something entirely different, and it should have a different word because...
All right, we got the point here. Michael.
So I think I want to say two things in response to Dave. I mean, first of all, yes, it's absolutely true that civil unions were something that same-sex couples were willing to accept back when the Vermont Supreme Court 13 years ago said you have to provide, Vermont has to provide same-sex couples with the rights and obligations of marriage, but doesn't have to call it marriage. And the Vermont legislature said we won't call it marriage, we'll call it civil unions. Then, 3 or 4 years later, the Massachusetts Supreme Court was confronted with the same question, and they said, no, civil unions aren't good enough. It has to be marriage. And some people thought that would cause a problem, and part of the argument in my book is it did. It created a big backlash. If the Massachusetts court had been willing to accept civil unions and not insist that this be called gay marriage, I think it would have produced somewhat less resistance. It actually would have made things a lot easier for John Kerry in the 2004 presidential election because he had to support civil unions and oppose gay marriage and oppose the federal amendment barring gay marriage. It was a very complicated position he had to take, and it made it very difficult for him to run against George Bush on that issue. The other point I want to make, though, is simply, you know, you could have said the same thing that Dave is saying about interracial marriage, that people who were asking for a right to marry interracially were asking for access to something that was in some ways the same as traditional marriage, but in other ways different. So they were the same as traditional marriage in that it was a man and a woman who loved each other, who wanted to get married, but it was different in that they were members of different races, and traditionally most states forbade interracial marriage. You know, we made a decision, the Supreme Court made a decision, society made a decision that, you know, that was no longer a difference that we were willing to take notice of. An interracial marriage and an intraracial marriage were the same thing, they were both marriages. So you can say the same thing about same-sex marriage. It is like traditional marriages in some ways and not others. It is like traditional marriages in that you have two individuals who love each other and want to make a commitment to spend the rest of their lives together. It is different in that those two individuals are members of the same sex. And then the question becomes, should that difference be treated as relevant? And supporters of same-sex marriage are saying it's no more relevant than the difference that we used to treat as relevant but don't anymore, which is members of opposite racial groups getting married. So they don't regard it as a relevant difference. Mm. And I think we're kind of moving in that direction that many people, certainly my students, have a very hard time understanding even the argument for why it is relevant that it is two men rather than a man and a woman. They love each other. They want to make a commitment. They may want to raise children. Many opposite-sex couples don't procreate. Many opposite-sex couples don't decide to have children. Why is it that these are different marriages?
Adam in Milwaukee asks, what are the consequences if the Supreme Court were to rule against California's Proposition 8, which banned gay marriage?
So if the Supreme Court rules against Proposition 8, the Supreme Court is essentially affirming the lower court decision, and that means Proposition 8 will be invalid, which means that California will start marrying same-sex couples again. California already married about 17,000 of them between the court decision in May of 2008, which approved gay marriage, and Proposition 8, which overturned the court decision. If the Supreme Court affirms the California decision, or if the Supreme Court refuses to review the California decision, Proposition 8 will be gone, and California, by far the largest state, will start marrying same-sex couples again.
Does this have ramifications for all the other states?
It depends on whether they do it narrowly or broadly. The Ninth Circuit, which is the federal appellate court that decided the Proposition 8 case, decided it on such narrow grounds that it probably only applies to California's situation. Basically, the Ninth Circuit court said, because California had gay marriage, it was mandated by the court, they had it, and then they took it away by popular vote, but they were not allowed to take away anything but the name, because California court decision had mandated that same-sex couples have all the rights and benefits of marriage, but now the voters took away the name. The court said, we can't understand the logic of what California is doing when you give same-sex couples the right to get married, then you take away the name, but you continue to give them all the other rights and benefits of marriage. We don't understand what that could be other than a fit of spite or animus, and it is established constitutional law that governments cannot simply act out of hatred or animus toward a group. But that doesn't necessarily have ramifications for another state which has never allowed same-sex couples to marry. That would require a broader ruling from the Supreme Court.
Mm. Michael, thank you so much for being with us. It was really a very fascinating conversation and great book as well. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah. Our guest, Michael Klarman. Michael's book is From the Closet to the Altar, Courts Backlash and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. He's a professor of constitutional law and constitutional history at Harvard Law School, and he's author of a number of books on the civil rights movement, from Jim Crow to civil rights, won a lot of prizes, and he's written about Brown versus the Board of Education as well. A reminder, tomorrow we're going to be in Appleton at the History Museum at the Castle in downtown Appleton from 9 to 11. We'll be talking about Leonardo da Vinci Machines in Motion, which is the exhibit there, and also we'll be looking at efforts to encourage technical education and fill skilled manufacturing jobs in the Fox Valley. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program, and thanks for your calls.